Welcome to the Andy Hicks Podcast, the one with Katie Dickens.
Good day, good afternoon, good evening, good wonderful day. Welcome to the Andy Hicks Podcast. I'm here today with Katie Dickens, Executive Head Teacher of Welford and Wickham and Stockcross Schools in West Berkshire. Welcome, Katie.
Hello, Andy. How are you?
Oh, very well, thank you. All the better for having you with us. Thank you so much for giving up your time.
Pleasure.
I wonder if you could start us off with giving the listeners a little insight into Katie and what's your story, your journey, where you come from and how you've ended up as a head teacher in West Berkshire.
Okay, so lovely to talk to you, Andy. I probably started my teaching career at the age of four, actually, because that's when my parents bought me a blackboard and easel. And having been brought up by a teacher, I think I was always destined to join the profession, despite my little forays into other things along the way. So really, I think teaching has been in my blood for my entire life, really. But as I say, I tried to do other things along the way. Did the usual kind of primary school, secondary school, but was actually the first member of my family to go to university. And I was kind of instilled with that desire to improve myself and be the best that I could be by my parents. And it was very much, you know, O-levels, A-levels, university, and that's what I was going to do. Probably one of the downsides of being the daughter of a teacher, a secondary school teacher who worked for 40 years in the same secondary school, about 10 minutes
Good
walk
grief.
From where we lived, was that I kind of started to live and breathe that whole education journey, the sort of Monday mornings, the butterflies my mum would have before she went to do her assembly, you know, as I walked with her and sort of we walked together and chat along the way with my sister. And then we would sort of leave her at school and then we'd carry on to the bus stop. And seeing all the kind of challenges that she faced in her teaching career, it was very much a case of I wasn't going to do that. I wasn't going to become a teacher
okay,
at all.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah okay,
wasn't,
yeah.
Wasn't going to be involved in that. So my other kind of talent was languages, and I was very much seen as I was going to be the career girl. I was going to go off and I was going to learn languages and I was going to be a European parliament lawyer or something like that. That was kind of the career path that was kind of laid out for me, I suppose. That kind of all went horribly wrong when I didn't do terribly well in my A-levels and ended up, rather than doing German and French and kind of like a business studies course, I ended up doing Russian from scratch at university, along with German and actually a law degree. So the degree was quite complex and quite challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, from that point of view, it gave me an insight into the legal profession, and I decided I wasn't cut out for it. I couldn't argue my way out of a paper bag, really. let alone for any kind of decent legal argument down on paper. So that kind of came to an end rapidly. And at the end of university, that kind of O-levels, A-levels university, it felt like I was dropping off a precipice. And at the time, it was difficult to get a job. So I was left at the end of university thinking, well, I've got nowhere to live and I've got no job. And two things happened. First of all, I managed to get a job working for a computer software company, which I did for 2 years. And then I then also fortuitously found free, totally free, didn't cost me anything, accommodation in an independent boarding school in Leafy, Surrey, in return for doing two evenings a week working with the girls in the boarding house and just kind of looking after them, which was brilliant. And I loved it. And it was really, you know, that whole kind of idea of education was still kind of there. And after 2 years of working in a computer software company where I worked telephone support shifts for market research companies who had problems with their programming software, at the end of that 2 years, I made the decision, actually, I would be a teacher. I was going to go and do my PGCE. So I got married, started my PGCE, and went and did the secondary PGCE at Homerton College in Cambridge, where I was training to teach secondary German and French.
Okay.
Then kind of fast forward 2 or 3 years, by that time we'd moved to Spain, I'd had a baby, and I didn't really have anything to do with teaching. I just about finished my, I didn't even barely finish my NQT year, to be honest, because my husband was, my new husband at the time, was working in Spain, so we'd sort of upped sticks and went to Spain, and then I stayed at home for 5 years, and did things along the way, like helped out in an after-school club and did adult ed, teaching German and Spanish. And then we moved from Cambridgeshire to Oxfordshire. By that time, I'd done probably about 18 months working in a secondary school part-time while my older two children were at nursery. So I got my sort of, got back into the teaching side of things. And then when we moved to Oxfordshire, I was told there was a shortage of teachers, and everywhere we went to look to move to, it was, oh, you've got a teaching qualification. Would you like to come and work with us? And I ended up working at Harwell Primary School, having done a return to teaching secondary to primary conversion course. And I worked at Harwell Primary School very happily for 10 years. It was brilliant. I loved it. And then kind of as part of that and the whole primary languages thing, I then did advanced skills teacher qualification and Ofsted inspection all to myself for a whole day and got what was the AST.
So
quite a circuitous route, really, because I never then became, I never became a deputy. I worked very closely with my head teacher, Peter Cancel, who was brilliant, loved working with Peter. And he taught me to believe in myself and actually gave me that sort of insight into what headship could be like, and actually thought I'd be a really good head teacher. Did some work with Oxford Brookes and a lot of work with primary languages side of things, and came to West Berkshire after my time with Oxford Brookes ended, and I was picked up by the lovely Florence Rostron at Welford to work with her for a year, and that was the year I worked for her and for Peter at Harwell and did my headship qualification, and they both supported me and they were my joint mentors, and I learnt huge amounts from them. So that's where I started to kind of get into the headship side of things, through quite an unusual route, really.
Indeed, yes, it's definitely the first description of that kind of route that we've had on the podcast, and maybe it's I neglected to mention, Katie, at the top here that it has been utterly remiss of me, but you are the first lady to be on the podcast that I've interviewed, I'm absolutely delighted about that. I'm very grateful for you giving up your time. And I suppose one could argue that some of that circuitous route was perhaps the result of family and motherhood. I'm not sure. I don't think it all is, actually. I think actually it was more about just figuring it out, really. But I don't know what you think about that.
Well, one of the things I was thinking about was that I didn't ever imagine that I would end up being an executive head teacher, and nothing about this was ever really planned. It's about, I suppose, taking opportunities as they arise, really, and thinking really carefully about the opportunities that are available and what you choose to take. So yes, a lot of it was, I mean, 5 years at home, literally to the day, fortunately for my pension, because if I'd had one day more, then it would have completely changed all my pension arrangements. But even that wasn't planned. You know, it was literally the way that things were at the time for us as a family. And I don't suppose I'm not. I joked with my son the other night about the fact I wasn't a dedicated natural mother. I always had to be doing something else as well.
Interesting. All right. So in amongst all that, executive head now. Yeah. Previously head teacher of a small village school as well. Yeah. A linguist.
Yes.
What would be your professional hedgehog? What's your one thing that you? I mean, it's a bit of a clumsy phrase, but you know, world class. But you know, the hedgehog's bloody brilliant at rolling up into a ball and protecting itself. That's the whole idea of the metaphor. Yeah. What would you say you're bloody brilliant at?
Well, I've been giving this a lot of thought, and I think it's about. It's doing that to schools thing, I think, and I really kind of I love that whole being in two different places and having lots of things going and managing all that and mm-hmm. doing the time management mm-hmm. of it and the organisation of it. I thrive on challenge, and I actually find running two schools, believe it or not, easier than running the one. And it sounds bizarre because you think, well, it's twice the workload. But actually the benefits of being able to see things side by side and similar situations and being mm-hmm. able to kind of have that constant benchmarking going on really helps me to do what I do, and I think I do it pretty well, actually. I run two very happy schools, great atmospheres, lovely teams, and I think kind of linked to that is the fact that I'm also really good about at knowing which people are going to work together well and spotting mm-hmm. that talent and making sure the teams mm-hmm. work well. Because I couldn't do what I do if the teams weren't right. So I have to have that insight and, you know, have that, I suppose at the heart of it is that ability just to kind of, for the most part, assess people. And this sounds a bit odd, really, because I don't mean it in a horrible way, but just to be able to kind of know straight away when somebody walks through the door, are they going to work in my team really well or not? Do you see what I mean? I think that's really important to have that ability to value everything that people bring to the table.
Do you think that duality almost is, as a very much a non-linguist, somebody who's just got a smattering of French is about as good as it gets. I know one or two people who would firmly put themselves in the linguist camp.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that they do tend to, even if they're speaking German, French, Russian, whatever it may be, oftentimes they're thinking in English.
Right.
As their first language. And I wonder whether there's this sense of duality. You talked about two schools, you talked about being able to compare. And I wonder whether the fact that you did pursue languages to a high level, to a of competency, whether that kind of sense of two things going on at once is something that sits naturally for you.
Yeah, I suppose I've never seen it like that, Andy, but I think you're probably right. I've always had, I suppose, my the way that my brain works, my level of competency in German, for example, now, I'd spent a lot of time in Germany, lived in Germany, studied in Germany. My level of competency with German is such that I don't actually need to think in English. I don't do that kind of translation thing. And I think one of the ways in which I suppose I see it is not so much wearing hats, but also but very much kind of adapting, being very adaptable to different scenarios and different people, and I suppose almost having like different levels of persona that appear at different times depending on what's happening. And I certainly felt that when I was in Germany, that was certainly a real kind of source of gaining confidence, really, because I could be a different person in German, and I could have a different character in German than I did in English. So I suppose that sense of duality, yes, definitely, from the point of view of, you know, where does one find sources of strength and confidence and resilience, if you like, and that sort of whole feeling of being able to draw on those different personas within a leadership framework is certainly, yes, yeah, very interesting, the more that I think about it. Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, you've just, yeah, as you described, you know, this somewhat circuitous route, and it's, you know, so it's of a reasonable length now as well. What's the one thing you wish you'd known right back at the beginning when you you were, you know, leaving university and heading towards teaching, having sort of stated categorically as a result of your mother's endeavours that you would never do such a thing? What was the one thing you wish you'd known when you did begin?
I think that I would become a head teacher. I think I wish I'd known that. Because I never had any sense of direction. And even when I was trying to become a head teacher, at points I thought, I'm never going to do this. I'm never going to get somebody to believe in me, to let me through the door. And then afterwards, you know, when you get that label head teacher, you're kind of constantly pinching yourself, I think, to sort of, have I really done it? You know, have I really got to that point? And I think when I think back of the head teachers that I have known, either because they've been influential in my primary school, particularly Mr. Cranfield was amazing as a head teacher, and then sort of, or as a somebody who I've worked with as a professional colleague, that label head teacher comes with so much, doesn't it, for everybody? It's seen by everybody in a different way, and to have finally made it, to have that label attached to my name, I think if I'd known that I was going to get there at the beginning, I might have done things slightly differently, I suppose. I might have noticed more things along the way that would have helped me, perhaps.
Okay, interesting. Well, you just sort of hinted towards my next question there, really, which is the slightly unfair phrase, perhaps, or a very challenging phrase, but what is your biggest failure, which is, you know, to say, when did perhaps something not go right or something go wrong, and what did you learn from it?
I think one of the hardest things about being a head teacher in a small school is, and as a new head teacher in a small school, is trying to be all things to all people all the time. And you're so, well, I was so intent on proving that I could do the job and that I could do everything. But in a small school, quite often you have to, don't you? You go from sort of talking to your business manager about, I don't know, the finances, to chatting to a teacher colleague who maybe has some concerns about a child, to unblocking the toilet. You know, the kind of the range of job, and it doesn't stop there. I mean, as you know, there is no job description that describes what we do. So trying to be all things to all people, actually, and getting to the point where I was working ridiculous hours, and then being in a situation where I was plunged into a family crisis with absolutely no energy behind me, was absolutely horrific. And actually, that was possibly my biggest learning curve, along the lines of, you know, having to put your own health and your family first. You know, whatever happens, you can't allow the job to. Because it would be.
I don't know if you just lost a little bit of signal there. Can you still hear me? Yeah, that's fine.
Hello,
we can deal with that. Okay.
Yeah.
So in relation to, so you talked about health and family, and how that's important to try and get their priorities right. What advice would you give someone wanting to pursue a career in education? Is it something like that, or is it something different?
No, I think it's very linked to that. I think it's about being choosy. Be really choosy about where you work and who you work for, because I think there's a school for everybody. And, you know, the way things are at the moment, it's definitely a buyer's market, isn't it, in terms of teachers being out there. What you know, I know that the supply is reasonably low and that demand is high. So for a new teacher, if you want a career in teaching, if you want it to be sustained and not be in a situation kind of 3 to 5 years down the line where you're having to look for another job or even another career, then do your research and know where you're going to work, and know who you're going to work for, and take your time about that. Because I think teaching is such a personal career. I think, you know, we all, for the most part, we do it because we care about the children. And, you know, it's a vocation. And if you're not going to be in the right place, you can be damaged very quickly if you've not got the right care and protection and support around you, because of the workload, because of things that can come out of left field, because of the families that you're dealing with. So I would say,
absolutely. I think the metaphor that springs to mind is, you know, is the flourishing plant. You know, the one if you put, you know, a plant in the wrong type of soil or with the wrong conditions, they're just not going to flourish, and things are going to be really tricky. And I think that taking your time, and that's really really insightful comment. It's fascinating to, and somewhere in amongst that is probably patience as well. And I know sometimes human nature creates an urgency that about getting on with things, and the people talk about risk taking, and you know, and what. But at the same time, I think that's it's really interesting to see that you've got, you know, there's plenty of opportunities, and you know, and as far as you can, using the information available, you try and make good decisions. Okay, on this journey of languages and teaching and parenthood and family and into leadership. What are the best resources that have helped you along the way?
I think what I would say is I rely hugely on my own memory. I think I'm quite blessed with a good memory. So it means I remember people's names, and one of the key things, I suppose, is being able to kind of just remember, where did I leave a conversation with somebody and how can I pick that back up? Or just remembering little tiny bits or little bits of information about people's lives so that you can connect back to them. And I think that's been a really important thing for me. And I know that there have been times when, you know, my memory started to go and I found it really frustrating, because I suddenly realised I can't remember somebody's name and I'm so used to being able to do it. So my memory is so important to me. I think the other thing I would say is that people as a resource, I think knowing how to get the best out of people and getting them to support me to do the job is vital, really, really important. And I would say my electronic diary. That's the last thing I would say in terms of being able to manage my time, think strategically about how I'm going to plan my time and making sure that it's not overloaded, I think has been one of my key resources. It's the thing I probably use on a day-to-day basis.
With the last one, is it appointments only, or do you put tasks in as well, things like that?
So I will allocate time for things. I will look ahead and try and decide what do I need to do and how can I prioritize things. And I'm also a little bit sneaky because I put in things like strategy meeting, and there are only a couple of people who know what that means, and that is, you know, me having a meeting with myself. Basically, it's me blocking time so that I can stay on top of things and have some thinking time to move things forward, and that's really valuable. So I kind of, yes, it is slightly task orientated, but it's probably a nice balance of both, really. And there are certain things that punctuate the week. At the moment on Mondays, I do assemblies in both schools on Monday mornings so that my deputies can run whole staff briefings and that sort of thing. So practical stuff like that goes in, as well as the sort of, you know, making sure that I've got time allocated for certain things. Deadlines go in, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, super stuff. Okay. Yeah. So you've mentioned a few people already. Who are the three people? Only three, not five, not... Yeah. Who are the three people who have been most influential to you?
So the first one is a lady called Christina. And I met Christina probably back in sort of the early 90s, and we've stayed firm friends ever since. She's a linguist, and we had a great time working together. We worked together for Oxfordshire County Council and part of Oxford Brookes, and we did some amazing things. She was the lead for the languages PGC students, because at the time when languages was big on the agenda, we were taking in PGC students who were trained to be primary languages teachers. So we did brilliant stuff with them. We organized placements for them in France and Germany and went out to see them teaching there, and we did things like we organised a huge event with all the year threes in Didcot, and we got them all into sports hall, and we did kind of almost like speed date teaching. So the students had to plan a quick kind of 20-minute language lesson and then teach it three times to three different groups of children, kind of as a massive, massive carousel. And we just worked together brilliantly. And I suppose we had these wacky ideas that we made happen. And she taught me to kind of have vision and dream big and keep going until it actually worked. And then the second person I would choose is my lovely neighbour, Di. And Di and I, we, up until recently, we used to go for a weekend stomp out into the fields. And we're both leaders of different organisations. I think one of the most valuable things that you can have is somebody who is a leader, but in a different style of organisation. And she's actually a principal of an FE college, a very successful FE college. And she has taught me to kind of make sure I stand back and try to see a situation from a more objective viewpoint. And that's been valuable on more than one occasion, to think that I've got the spirit of Di sitting on my shoulder. And what would Di do in this situation? And, you know, how would she see this? And that's been really, really helpful. And the last one absolutely is my mum, because she's taught me the importance of taking care of myself and valuing myself, and, you know, the importance. I mean, I can, those walks to school every day, you know, we used to talk about the importance of mental health in at a time kind of in the early 80s when mental health wasn't really an issue. It wasn't really valued. It wasn't really recognized. And she's, you know, she had the foresight and the to kind of instill those, that recognition that it's not just about physical health, it's about mental and emotional health as well. And that whole idea that mental health is just as important. And I think as certainly as I got older, I hear her voice in my head far more, because I'm sort of recognizing things that she probably was going through at that sort of stage in her life. And just being mindful of it, really, just remembering to take care of yourself physically, emotionally and mentally,
love
on
that.
All levels.
That's wonderful. And you got a bit of everything there, professional, personal, family as well. Really nice. Really nice. Katie, well entrenched in the education hinterland, for want of a better phrase, as you have been for the last number of years, what's the one common myth about education that you want to debunk?
Well, do you know what? I thought I'm going to look up what a common myth in education is. And most at the moment. The value of homework.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, lost you.
Oh, okay.
So it's the value of homework. I think we're in, certainly for primary school children, I think that there is a pressure brought to bear sometimes by a view that homework actually supports learning. There's no research that actually substantiates this. And I would say that what we need to remember is that children copy their parents more than anybody else. And if parents can spend time with their children in a constructive, quality way by playing games, talking to them, taking them out for walks, actually just being together as a family, showing kindness, taking big questions and having real earnest discussion about them, and allowing children to express their opinion and explore their thoughts. I think this is far more valuable than any piece of homework that a tired teacher might set of a Friday afternoon, and then it be collected in, having probably been argued about and, you know, sort of, I remember tears and tears over homework in our house. and actually it's of no value, and you know, whether parents end up doing it for the child.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's something that needs to be done rather than actually valuing the task itself. So I think I would prefer to call it A, home learning, and B, I would prefer it to be more skills based around spending time as a family. The kind of timing of this interview, Andy, is interesting, isn't it, with everything that's going on?
Yes, absolutely.
And actually, one of the things that I'm seeing is that one of the challenges that families are facing is the ability just to have a routine, you know, just having a daily routine where everybody gets up and gets dressed and has breakfast together and then goes off and does their own thing for a little while, or does something together, and then they have lunch together, and then they go off and do whatever it is, and then have a meal together in the evening. You know, and then a decent sleep routine so that everybody feels like they've had a positive day. And I think certainly amongst the disadvantaged families that I've seen, that the lack of routine is really damaging. So I think, you know, home learning and home learning, those kind of strategies to create good routines and working together as a family, I think are key, and it's quite worrying how many families are not able to do that. So that's kind of where I would be going with home learning going forward.
Fascinating.
Rather than homework.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, I've fired a few questions at you. If you could step into my shoes, what would you have asked yourself that I haven't asked you?
So I thought quite hard about this one. I thought, if I was you, I'd have asked you, what are the three golden rules that you stick to in your working life? And I would have three, obviously, my three golden rules. The first thing is that I stick to the 80-20 rule. I try not to work or give more than 80%, because I think you always need 20% capacity in case something goes wrong. You've always got to have something left in the tank.
Yeah.
In case something happens. If you're constantly working at 100% all the time, you've got nothing else left to give. The second golden rule, if you like, is I stick with what I know as the three C's, which has been, you know, something again from my mum, which is courtesy, consistency and compassion. I think those would be kind of the key values that I would stick with. You know, all wrapped up in that is the way that you talk to people and the level of kindness you show, and how you do that in a way which is consistent with people around you. And the third thing is, I would say, as a golden rule, is about being myself when I make decisions, and trying as much as I can to be myself when I make those decisions. I've read a brilliant quote in a book called Brave Heads. And it says there are four rules for being a head teacher. Number one, be yourself. Number two, be yourself. Number three, be yourself. Number four, there are no rules. And I think, you know, it's great. And it's about when you make that decision, you make that decision as true to yourself as you can, and that means kind of warts and all, really, knowing and apologizing when you get it wrong. So those would be my kind of
three golden rules. Love it. Absolutely love that. Love that. Yeah, very much so. Goodness me. I shall have to dwell on that one. Okay. Thank you. Okay, Katie, if listeners want to connect with you or find out more about your professional work or anything like that, how can they connect?
So I'm on LinkedIn,
mm-hmm.
and I'm also I'm also on Twitter.
Okay, great. Super stuff. Well, and just if people just search for Katie Dickens, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
There's not very many of me. I think the other one's an Australian model, and that's definitely not me.
Ah, okay. Well, people may be forgiven for making that mistake. One never knows. Okay, super stuff. All right. Well, hugely appreciative of your time. I'm now going to come to what I like to call the secret sauce question. It's got three parts to it. It's kind of like, you know, that it's the iron brew moment of this chat, Katie. It's that what's hidden away in how you do what you do that is your way, and it's what do you do every day, every week, and every term.
Okay. So I think every day is that whole idea going back to connecting with people. Remember that little conversation that you've had. It could be with a child, it could be with a parent, it could be with a member of staff. And as you see them again throughout your day, it's reconnecting with them. How did that go? Or, oh, what happened about so-and-so? And if you can't remember, just saying, oh, how lovely to see you. You know, and smiling at them, and that's what I find a lot of my day is, really, just that whole reconnecting with people.
Brilliant.
Every week, what do I do every week? I would say, so on the ground every week, I write a newsletter.
Okay.
I feel that helps me connect with the wider community.
Mm-hmm.
There have been times where I've had feedback from parents who have said, "I love what you read in the news, what you wrote in the newsletter this week. It helped me too."
Right. Okay. And
quite frankly, I've got to the stage now. I've been doing it for 5 years. I think for most people, it's probably like wallpaper. And I sometimes think, oh, how can I change this up and what can I do differently? I suppose for me, I've got to that stage now where it doesn't matter that for some people it's wallpaper. Actually, it's chronicling the life of our school.
Yes.
And it's a great record for the last 5 years of the things that we've done and some of the things I talk about. So that's kind of almost like my bloggy bit, I suppose, but in a way which
the old-fashioned school log.
Yeah, but taking different themes depending on what's happening and, you know, what's been in the news recently, or, you know, just trying to find different ways of connecting with people, whether that's kind of on an informational level or on a spiritual level. Obviously, running Church of England Schools, you know, I do put kind of some spiritual things in there,
mm-hmm.
and that sort of thing. So I think, you know, just trying to do that. And then every term, I would say it's meeting colleagues, actually, whether that's just making sure that I connect with Heads Breakfast, or if I can't make it, then finding out what's happened, or chatting to head teacher colleagues individually or as a small group over coffee. So I suppose for me, the whole thing is about being connected throughout, whether, you know, within whatever sphere I'm working at, whether it's a school level or a home level, or, you know, as a professional in a wider context, kind of just that whole energy that comes from connecting with people, I would say that is my secret sauce.
Love it. Great way to sum it up. Great way to sum it up. Katie, thank you so much for your time today. It's been an absolute privilege to listen to your reflections and to hear about your journey through schools and education and family life. And just so grateful. Thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
Well, take care. All the best. I hope that somewhere when the new normal resumes, then, you know, I hope that it all goes well for you and yours and schools and throughout the rest of 2020.
Thank you. Same to you, Anne.